Good evening. It's Behind the News, where we bring you detailed analysis of the day's news. My name is George Asikri. Tonight, pressure mounts on government as churches and add their voices to the call on President Mahama's administration to address the energy crisis and other economic challenges. And the amendment of Article 71 of the Constitution for high public office holders. Is it enough to reduce the huge wage bill on the so-called big men in Ghana? We'll find out shortly. Stay tuned for the next 1 hour as we bring you details of all these stories on our program tonight. But first, Agatha Samoa is here with the summary.
Thanks, George. President John Mahama has announced the decision of government to amend Article 71, which gives special emolument to the president, vice president, and other office holders. President Mahama said he has directed the Public Services Commission and the Ministry of Employment and Labour Relations to embark on reforms in the public sector. He said the reform is to change the perception that the public sector is synonymous with inefficiency. Regional hospitals have been tasked to ensure that psychiatric units are established before the close of this year or face sanctions. The acting CEO of the Mental Health Authority, Dr. Akwesi Oseyin, said when these units are created, it will help integrate mental health into general health practice, which will reduce the stigma against psychiatric patients. The Upper East Regional House of Chiefs have been asked to, as a matter of urgency, step in the enschemement of new chiefs in Bolga. The sector minister, Dr. Henry Seju Dana, made the appeal to Radio Ghana over the enschemement of the new Bolga Naba. And UK re-elected Prime Minister David Cameron has promised to unite the country and make Great Britain greater as he returned to Downing Street as Prime Minister. Speaking outside Number 10 after visiting Buckingham Palace, he said the UK is on the brink of something special in the coming years. In the elections, the Conservatives won 331 seats, 5 more than needed for a Commons majority. This is the first such victory since 1992.
There are hundreds of patriotic Ghanaians who have served the nation and have gone home with lucrative retirement packages that go with their high office. Yet there are others who may strive for such high public office not because of patriotism, but the fact that they will benefit from the largesse of the state as prescribed by Article 71 of the Constitution. If there are entering, or if you are entering into politics, or you targeting any high office position primarily because you want to enjoy what we want to describe as the financial salvation of Article 71 office holders, then pause and listen. The president, John Mahama, says that article will be amended and in its place will be an independent emolument commission. That commission will determine the conditions of service of the big men in Ghana, including justices of the superior courts, members of parliament, executive, bosses of commissions like the Commission on Human Rights and Administrative Justice, Shiraj, the Electoral Commission, and many others. This, the president believes, will reduce the wage bill. On the line tonight is Bernard Mona. He's the general secretary of the PNC. Bernard joins us all the way from Takrade, where this decision was taken. Good evening and welcome to Behind the News.
Good evening, George.
Thanks for your time on our program. Article 71 office holders, and then now we're hearing of an independent emolument commission. What will be the difference?
First, let me say that I feel totally privileged to be part of the Who's Who conference of the single spine policy. We got an invitation to be part of these processes, and I can tell that I have attained some knowledge that hitherto was not available to me, particularly in the group sessions that we participated. First, I think that the president was spot on, and this is in line with the PNC position and my personal thinking over the period, that there cannot be any reason why workers of Ghana should be segregated in terms of Article 71 office holders who are seen as privileged office holders as against the rest of the nation. And in particular, when it has been the effort of government to rationalize and to bring all of us into a pay policy that will be decent enough for all of us, to create another tier of incentives for another group will mean that we are indeed not respecting the single spine pay policy and indeed the work of the Fair Wages Commission. So to call for a national emolument body, I think that for us, it's not even the case. We should just put it under the Fair Wages and Salaries Commission to determine for all Ghanaians and all categories of workers how much should be paid per your various risk, your various levels of contribution and productivity. And I think that the president made mention and call on labor, organized labor, to join the president and indeed the Constitutional Implementation Review Committee so that at the end of the day, they will implement the provisions that the constitutional recommendations made, that we should have an emolument body that would determine for the entire nation how much each person should earn, which office you hold, and therefore, at the end of the day, we'll all come under one particular or what I call an omnibus structure where all of us can then say that we go to do our negotiation than for Fair Wages to be determining some other Ghanaian workers' emolument. When the president's emolument is determined by parliament and parliament's emolument is determined by the president, I think that it is not fair. And so I concord absolutely to the decision, particularly the call by the president, that organized labor should join them in the push for this to be realized.
It looks like that will bring parity, but the question is, how will that reduce the wage bill?
Well, I am not certain that that is an issue. If you listen to the discussions, particularly by the Minister for Finance, you listen to discussions by the 3UC Secretary General, you come to the conclusion that reducing the wage bill is not necessarily an issue about of bringing pay parity, but that one, there are goods that establish or exist within our status, and that those who manufacture these goods must be dealt with punitively so that at the end of the day, they will lose their ability to manufacture or to give birth to goods. That way, you'll be able to reduce the number of people who are not working, who have done no work and are on the pay streak. It is also important, listening to the Controller and Accountant General herself, that says that, look, over the period, there are people who have gone on retirement, people who have left the service, and it's difficult to be able to determine when they have left the service and their payment continue to go through the system. This time around, they are putting innovative measures to ensure that they are able to track those who have gone on pensions, those who have died, and others who have left service and yet their payments continue to go through their bank account, so that we'll be able to checkmate the exodus or the flow of resources as a result of our inability to track this. It is also important to state that there should be, and this I think is a moral suasion issue, there should be among the workers, particularly at organized labor in the various departments, to begin to monitor, to check who and who are we working with, so that at the end of the day, the list possibly of those who are working can be circulated for approval by organized labor. When that happens, we'll be able to eliminate the names that are sent out or into the Controller and Accountant General. And at the end of the day, it will inform the reduction in our wage bill. Above all, we need to increase productivity. And what I have said over time is that all the time we are talking about increase in productivity. But who will bring the indicators for productivity to be increased? It is the employer who will have to establish benchmarks, indicators for accelerated productivity. If the employer does not do so, it is not the employee who will come and determine determine what will be the benchmarks or indicators for increase in productivity. So even as we are calling on Ghanaians to increase their work rate, it is important for the employer, in this particular case, government and the employers association, to bring about things that will lead to a quantum leap in the rate at which we are producing. And when we augment productivity, we generate a lot of revenue. I'm sure that our percentage in terms of how much is spent of tax revenue or of revenue in general, vis-a-vis wages, would be seen to be reducing, particularly so when wages will be an insignificant portion of the revenues that we generate.
Looking at all these things, those who contribute in generating the ghost names, it appears it's a syndicate. And once you go in to scrap this, it means that somebody's daily bread will be affected. How do you foresee the reactions of the people? The very people, I believe, talking about it may be involved or may have knowledge of those who are doing it.
Well, when the president gives a fiat, the president gives a backing to actions to be taken and calls for prosecution of persons that are found to be culpable or endorsing such a process, it's obvious that you realize that there is no hideout. There will not be a cover for any other person, because a minister of state will not be able to protect somebody when the president has said openly that, look, deal with the person. A head of department who is caught will have to be dealt with according to the law. And indeed, if a head of department wants to protect somebody that is found guilty of the law and the president's call will be the one that will be the overriding. And I think that it is a sufficient and a necessary impetus for the fight against ghost names in this country that the president states it in the unequivocal words that, look, we will hunt for the ghost, we will arrest them, we will prosecute them, and we will take punitive actions against them. By that, I'm sure that it's sufficient a deterrent for those who will be engaged in this. And those who are already engaged in this, it is time for them to begin to revise their nose and possibly do the right thing so that at the end of the day, you earn decent income and not filthy income.
Could this be an IMF imposition?
Certainly, this is a homegrown policy.
So, when is this whole seminar ending?
It will end tomorrow. We've virtually concluded with most of the syndicated group discussion. Tomorrow, we'll go into the plenary for public discussion and commentary on the various reports. And I'm sure that by 4 o'clock tomorrow, we should be done. And those of us who will be able to make it to Accra or to our various destinations will get back and to see how we can actualize the contents and the decisions that we have reached here.
I'm sure in all these things, the ordinary civil or public servant listening to us will be wondering, at the end of this, are we going to get some increment in what we take at the end of the month?
Well, that should be an issue of negotiation between or among the tripartite committee. And if you listen to the Minister for Employment, well, he said that by 23rd June, negotiations should be commenced, and that he hopes that they will conclude negotiation before September so as to allow the Minister for Finance in his 2016 budget presentation to capture the agreements by the labor unions, the employers association and government so that a decision will be reached. And I'm sure that that decision will lead many Ghanaian workers smiling back home.
All right, I want to thank you very much and thanks for talking to us. Wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, sir.
Bernard Mona is one of the stakeholders currently doing the discussions on the wage bill. He is also the General Secretary of the People's National Convention, PNC. Still on this issue, let's take a listen at what the President said at Takoradi.
My comrade Kofi Asamoah has always maintained that labor alone is not responsible for this high wage bill. He says there are ghosts and Article 71 workers who also contribute to the wage bill. I will ask him to join us in pushing forward the constitutional reforms, in which one of the reforms is to abolish Article 71 and replace it with an independent emoluments commission. And so if Labour will be a partner with government, we should be able to move these constitutional reforms forward so that we have a fair and transparent platform on which all public sector workers, notwithstanding what category, are remunerated accordingly. I've asked that for the ghosts that are man-made, the human creators of these ghosts, when discovered, should be prosecuted. Where persons who have engaged in impropriety have been found out, like in the National Service Scheme, we will ensure prosecution if those people are caught up with. We expect that organized labor will be a partner in this fight. Various measures are being rolled out to improve the integrity of the payroll. This includes monthly payroll verification, which has begun to be sent to all your MDAs. We're continuing to conduct random staff audits, and this is being done in conjunction with the Controller and Accountant General's Department and the Bureau of National Investigations.
President John Dramani Mahama is behind the news live on Radio Ghana. We joined on the line by Mr. Kofi Asamoah, is the TUC Secretary General. Good evening and welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
So far, with what has been discussed, what is organized labor's view? Are you satisfied?
Oh, it depends on the issue. If you recall, we are meeting as a way of reviewing the single spine salary structure, particularly with implementation challenges that we have been able to experience since 2010, when the implementation was done. Indeed, I do not know what exactly you are talking about, but the point is that we have had stakeholders, unions, employers, public sector agencies, all gathered here. You recall that we did a similar one at home 2 years ago. The idea is to look at what the challenges are. And indeed, the public sector implementation has really endured a lot of challenges. The one major challenge which government has been using as a major argument has been the rising cost of
the wage bill.
And you may recall that they even came out to say that that was the burden, because as at that time, about 70% or beyond 70% of tax revenue are going into paying public sector workers. The argument that has been between us has been that we in labor, organized labor, has also challenged the wage bill, particularly because we are of the view that, yes, the single spine salary structure has achieved some gains. It has it's the only time that we were able to bring all public sector workers under one salary structure, which really is aimed at removal of distortions, overlappings, and also to seek some level of improvement in public sector pay. At a point in time, public sector was not able to get qualified people into the system because the pay levels were low.
Okay.
So when the 70% was really mentioned, you know, it attracted a lot of public interest. And we have almost always argued that we do not believe that the entire 70% represents what public sector workers have been granted. In our own view, the wage bill, so many things were made attributable to the wage bill. We have had cause to say that the wage bill has not been efficiently managed in the level that we have what can be said to be ghost names. We have had fraud and people engage in all forms of malfeasance. So even today, we also challenge still that now the wage bill, even though we are told that it's now come down to about 50-something percent, does not represent what exactly working people in the public sector has been paid. We are told that, yes, they've been able to detect some level of fraud, and as it happened in the case of the
National
Service Secretariat and other things. So we still insist that if the payroll is efficiently managed, all those people who are not really working and being paid or all those who are indulged in some form of fraud or the other, if those things are removed, we will see the real payment. Because as we sit here, in spite of everything, yes, we saw some gains of the public sector pay when the implementation started. Now, but with a whole lot of economic challenges, high cost of living, arising out of high tax rates, how do we call it, the CD depreciation, the face value of public sector incomes have been chiseled in a way.
Yes.
So today, it became, as part of the opening ceremony, issues were raised, and I heard you playing back what the president said. What I gathered from it was that they really informed us of all what they are doing to remove fraud and ghost names and other things, which has been the bane of the public sector pay, which is in the right direction, and we strongly support that, because if you look at salary levels of public sector pay, we are not so satisfied with the levels, given the high cost of living and other related matters. So it's a welcome thing, even though we know that if you embark on any element of fraud, you should be really prosecuted. Coming as it was from the president was quite a good thing. We are reviewing the entire public sector pay, and I'm talking about a single spine.
Okay.
And today, all of us rededicated our commitment as stakeholders to the fact that we need to make the single spine sustainable. We need to ensure that it works effectively. We need to ensure that all levels of negativities that are linked to the spine, particularly from fraud and ghost names and other things that are not acceptable, are removed.
The Article 71 office holders, we're hearing that there's going to be an independent emolument commission. Will that change anyway in terms of the quantum of money that goes to those people?
Currently, what existed is that if you take the public sector wage bill, it includes those on the single spine and those who are outside the single spine. So our argument is that if some people are outside the single spine and there's no level of control in them, how do you just say that you blame public sector wage bill as having been the cause of all the problems that we have in the country? You know, in the past, government functionaries were blaming or were attributing the problem with the wage bill to public sector, to the single spine. But the contention is that if you have some people outside the single spine where stakeholders don't control, how do they blame us? So perhaps the idea is that how do we ensure that some kind of machinery is put in place to ensure that all those who are paid by government who come under some level of control. We are yet to analyze whatever it means, but until those kind of controls are put in place, if they want to blame all the problems, all the woes of the country on public sector pay, we will disagree, because public sector pay includes others who we do not know and who we do not have any level of control to find out whether the correct thing is done or the wrong thing.
So as we speak, is organized labor aware of the exact amount or percentage that goes to people on the wage bill who are not directly on the single spine?
It's quite difficult to be able to establish that. And you may recall that one time we have challenged government about 2-3 times before to say that we should have a disaggregation of the figures for us to know what goes to what and what goes to the other. At the point in time, we were even raising the issue of ghost names. The impression was that there are no ghost names. But I think for now, government has conceded. Some people have been arrested here and there. And as the president said, it's not only ghosts who are not available, but people are consciously engaged in fraud from a level which has not been established. And I think that is the basis of what they were saying, that when you are caught, you will be dealt with. But for now, I think we are yet to establish the real... we can do it from a level, because based on those that are under, the unions, and also those who are paid directly from the single spine, we can be able to establish that. But it kept changing. periodically, and that's been the problem that we have.
Those of us on single spine, and regardless of the sector, what many are talking about is the allowances. And people are wondering. Some people believe they don't have allowance, they take certain amount. Others have allowance, they take virtually the same amount. What happens? Are they going to pay these monies?
No, it came out strongly. You know, the category two, they were all, one of the objectives of the single spine pay policy is also to harmonize not only the pay, but also the allowance.
What does that mean?
I mean, what it means is that because at various workplaces before the introduction of the single spine had other forms of negotiation machinery.
Okay.
They were negotiating their pay differently, even though all of them were employees of government and have been paid from the consolidated fund. They were being paid from various levels of negotiation machinery. And that is what was the distortion and kind of a situation where people of the same qualification, depending on where you find yourself, would rather be taking more or less. So one of the objectives of the single spine policy is to harmonize all those things, and it includes allowances. So as part of the process, allowances payments were halted. Because if you take one particular organization, that organization can have as many as about 10 allowances, whereas others have about 5 allowances. So all allowances that cut across were put together in a way of an attempt to harmonize. And that explains why allowances have not been paid over a period. The agreement has been that by June, we need to restore all these allowances in a well-shaped way to ensure that if the allowances are salary-related, it could then be made part of your pay. And that is what we mean by harmonize. So category 2 and 3 allowances are different allowances from one workplace to the other. But they are being brought together in a way to ensure that apart from harmonizing the salaries, others don't hide under allowances to get some improved conditions of service as against the others.
Those that organized labor will agree with stakeholders that they be paid. Will organized labor push that they be paid from when the single spine started, or
that's a matter for negotiation, and you cannot just conclude on anything.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your time, sir, tonight.
Thank you.
Kofi Asamoah is Secretary General of the Trades Union Congress. He's also the spokesperson of organized labor. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana. And still on this, we are joined on the line by Mr. Austin Gamma. He is a labor consultant. Good evening, sir, and welcome to the program.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And thanks for having you on our program tonight. On the Article 71 office holders and plans to put in its place an independent emolument commission, will that not lead to some labor unrest?
Well, it was the proposal the president mentioned in his speech. He did not necessarily frame it up. And the gathering here in Takwadi are looking at these things, and we make recommendations in the plenary session. We know it's a constitutional review commission's proposal. It's not been, put into referendum or whatever it is yet. If it's an entrenched clause, it will have to go to referendum. If they have to amend that aspect of it and bring it for something else other than an emolument commission, that one too is there. He mentioned it, but he didn't frame it up that it's compulsory.
That means that regardless of the outcome of this forum, that particular article and the issue being discussed, since it's in part of the Constitution Review Commission thing, it might take some time.
If it's an entrenched provision, then it will have to go to referendum. If it's not, and in fact, he made it in such a way that then the session is discussing it. We'll come to conclusion whether we should even go there, or there should be a way of getting another committee to determine it. So it's not a firm drafting.
But on the general issue of single spine and allowances and what is being discussed now, do you foresee some kind of agitation? Like people will say, yes, the single spine brought some kind of increment in workers' salary, but economic conditions indicators have eroded the gains.
Well, those things will be with all nations, including Ghana. Gains erosion will be with us a while. We are not a very developed nation, as we used to tout ourselves to be. We are growing content. Hopefully, we shall overcome one day. But for now, the situation we find ourselves in requires a lot of ingenuity and innovation to be put in place to come to some level that will help everybody. So I think that in fairness to ourselves as a people, the single spine pay policy is one of the best things that has happened to this nation. And it's up to us to find ways and means of implementing it in a way that we inure to the benefit of both the individuals and the whole nation. That is what we are trying to discuss to see how best to assist in its implementation.
And many will also be wondering how that will reduce the wage bill, because if the allowances are harmonized, certainly workers might demand more. If ghost names are reduced, maybe what was going to the ghost will go to workers.
There will be nothing wrong if workers get more. The only thing is that, is it something implementable? Is it something doable? Is this something that is in the best interest of all of us? Mind you, the workers who are being paid in the public service, the people who pay them includes you. You pay taxes to enable them to be paid. Even if you are working in the public sector, you contribute towards the work. And therefore, if you deserve it, fine. It is not something. That's why we cannot negotiate under duress. That is why we cannot negotiate under pressure. Everybody will have to open up and learn the art of negotiation through what permissible levels that the law allows. That is the way it's supposed to be.
From an expert like your view, should we start smiling as workers?
Our gathering here is not. It's about setting the parameters, it's about setting the right, manner in which people should engage. Linking pay with productivity and ensuring that the right thing is done. That is what is being done here. When we finish with the framework, fleshing it for implementation becomes a matter of people acquiring the knowledge and the necessary skills to be able to do it. And we are hoping people will learn lessons from the past and will not carry the past into today.
Linking pay to productivity appears theoretical. What can be done practically from what you are discussing to make that a reality?
There's a whole committee, subset committee, which is preparing that to be presented to the plenary session tomorrow. And my belief is that what will come out from this forum, if it's implemented, will go a long way to help the nation, even the private sector.
All right, I want to thank you very much, sir, for your time on our program tonight.
Most grateful.
Really appreciate you tonight. Austin Gama is a labor consultant. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana. Well, the heat is on as churches are calling on government to swiftly fix challenges concerning the energy crisis, the National Health Insurance Scheme, and other sectors of the economy. They contend that the energy crisis is seriously affecting all facets of the national economy. The repeated failure to reimburse pharmacy and hospital facilities is also collapsing the National Health Insurance Scheme. These issues were contained in a statement jointly signed by the president of the Ghana Catholic Bishops' Conference, Most Reverend Joseph Osei Bunsu, and Chairman of the Christian Council of Ghana, Right Reverend Professor Emmanuel Mate. So, what exactly does these churches want government to do as long-term measure in fixing these challenges? And what is the church also doing to assist government in ending, particularly the doomsday issue? Let's hear from the hero's own mouth, and We have Most Reverend Joseph Osebunsu, President of the Catholic Bishops Conference, on the line. Good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening, sir.
And thanks for your time. Is government not doing enough to fix the challenges facing the economy?
We don't think so, because the city, for example, is going down in value. Prices are very high. They've had to go for a bailout. All these are signs that the economy is not doing well.
What are the major challenges that the country needs to do and we find it difficult to do? Which areas that we have in the difficulty?
Well, I think one of your difficulty is the problem with the power. So, because you know, there's no power, the industry is suffering, a whole lot of business are suffering, individuals are suffering. And so I think the first step is to ensure that you have the power, you know. You can't run the country without power. It's difficult. The businesses will come to a standstill.
Your statement is coming at a time that government has announced a lot of measures, including the fact that power badges will arrive in the country by September. So what do you want government to do again?
Well, we have heard those promises before. A power badge was supposed to come in April. Now it's September. Come September, it may be another story. So we want to see something done, you know, very urgently. I don't know if that's the only solution, getting a power badge from Turkey. No, I don't know. But the country, you know, is not doing well in that area. So we think that government should sit up and do something more.
Let's look at the National Health Insurance Scheme, where the church, the Catholic Church in particular, pioneered that particular insurance before government rolled nationwide. What can government do to revive the scheme?
Well, I think you need discipline to run it. Because the way we see it, you know, payments are made to the National Health Insurance Authority, and these monies don't seem to be there. You know, so there should be a tighter controls on the monies that are paid in there, because for 6 months or 8 months, you know, these hospitals are not being paid. And so I think that there need to be, you know, tighter measures in terms of, you know, looking after the money. Maybe they can also go back and learn from the church. This, I think, started in Nkuranza. You know, that's where they learned it from. Maybe they should go back there and see how they did it.
You made mention of the Senchi Forum and that government should go back to the issues raised there. What issues were raised and have been abandoned, so to speak?
Now, what you are saying is this, that there was a forum, national forum, to which they invited all the economic gurus and so on, and we don't hear anything about it. Was it a waste of time or what? So at least we should be told that, you know, this policy or that policy is being implemented from the same consensus. But I don't hear anything at all.
Is there something that easily comes to mind?
No, I didn't take part. But what I know is that we haven't heard anything that this policy or that policy is coming from the same consensus. So we want to know what is happening to that report.
Most Reverend, I remember years ago, I went to Wild West in the Upper West region.
Yes.
The people there said that they do not know government. They know the Catholic Church, because whatever they had there, it was the church that provided. The question is, today we have the numbers, the churches, they make the money. What is the church doing to help the state come out of some of the challenges that we all suffering?
The church is doing a lot in the rural areas. You know that we have clinics and hospitals in very remote areas. You take the Ashanti side of the Front Plains, Oku and Drobonso. Those are my dioceses. These are remote areas where government doesn't go to any hospitals. So the church, you know, those schools and clinics, and, you know, in these places. So thereby we contribute to the, you know, the welfare of the people. And so the church does a lot, you know. I mean, if you take hospitals, for example, you take all the mission hospitals in the country, I mean, they are a lot, and they are the best in the way you take the schools and so on. So the church is doing a lot already. These things should be provided by the state. But because the state is not able to provide them, the church comes in. And we are doing our best to provide schools, clinics and hospitals and so on.
What are you saying to the other churches? Like you're saying, that's a fact. But we know that it's some particular churches, the Orthodox churches and few of the Pentecostal churches that are into this. There are yet other churches that we don't see much. What is, for instance, the Catholic Bishops Conference and the Christian Council telling those churches as well?
Well, we cannot go and tell them what to do. I mean, we are doing what we are doing because of our conviction that we must live the gospel that we preach. We must go to the help of the poor. We must reach out to the sick, the poor, and so on. And so we are doing it out of our conviction. And we cannot go and tell them that this is what you should do. Maybe a day will come when they will be moved to do something similar, but we cannot go and tell them to go to a remote area and build a hospital. It has to come from them.
All right, Most Reverend, I want to thank you very much for your time on Radio Ghana tonight.
Thank you very much.
Most Reverend Joseph Osebunsu is the president of the Ghana Catholic Bishops Conference. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Meanwhile, on this particular issue, the public affairs director of the National Health Insurance Scheme, Selom Adonu, says the scheme has been running a fund gap since 2010, at a time when expenditure was high with increasing population and beneficiaries. To him, this is part of the problem facing the scheme. He said this in an interview with George Ankra.
NHIS is a social intervention program, and it's a program which has almost everybody or every household in Ghana representing. So anything which happens to the NHIS goes to the very core of the Ghanaian's heart. And the issue is that the NHIS has been running a funding gap since 2009-2010. And this funding gap has come as a result of the fact that, you know, our income is now less than our expenditure. You know, when the scheme started in 2005, the income was far, far, far greater than the expenditure. So we had surpluses. And that makes sense because you had just 1.9 million people on the scheme at the time. And the utilization of the scheme was not as high as we have it today. Fast forward, in 2014, that number has risen to 10.2 million people. And these 10.2 million people come with their healthcare needs. They go to the hospital once, twice, three or four times. Some people don't go at all. That is fine. But the utilization of the scheme has grown exponentially. Meanwhile, the sources of income have remained relatively the same. The income the NHIS receives from its sources of income, like the tax, like the SNIT, like the premium, and all those things put together, is not enough to fund the operations of the scheme as we have it. And the situation we find ourselves in today is not peculiar just to Ghana. In every health insurance scheme everywhere in the world, there is what we call the sustainability regime, which should be redefined periodically. So what we have done is that in redefining that sustainability regime, there are a number of options or suggestions we are making to the people of Ghana. And I believe that deliberations are ongoing. We've engaged stakeholders a number of times since 2010. We've been engaging stakeholders on this same agenda. You know, and a lot of these stakeholder engagements have churned out some options or suggestions. For example, people think that the law regarding the operation of the NHIS, the National Health Insurance Act 2012, Act 852, should portions of it should be looked at. There is a blanket exemption of all persons under 18 years. The question is, does it mean that anybody under 18 years is unable to pay about 20 or 25 cedis the whole year for the person's health care? If you are a very rich person and your child is under 18 years, does that mean that you cannot pay for that child? That is one matter we should look at. People even think that it's not equitable to do it that way. It should be on need basis. If you can pay, yes, you pay the premium. If you cannot pay because you have limited economic activity, which can be proven, then government will take care of you as it is already doing.
Selom Adonu is the public relations director of the National Health Insurance Scheme, talking to us earlier in reaction to the news conference and the statement from the Catholic Bishops Conference and the Christian Council of Ghana. Welcome back. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Tomorrow marks exactly 14 years after some 126 spectators died in a stampede at the Accra Sports Stadium in a titanic clash between Kumasi Asante Kotoko and Accra House of Hook. the two most glamorous football clubs in the country, particularly at the time. The police had to resort to the use of tear gas to control a riot after the match, resulting in the stampede and the subsequent death of the soccer fan. But after more than a decade after that incident, what have we learned as a nation? Behind the News, explore this tonight, and on the line is Dan Kweku Yeboah. He's a sports analyst. Good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening, my brother. It's a pleasure.
14 years after this stadium disaster, what have we learned as a country?
I think practically we have learned nothing as a country. Year in, year out, we keep paying lip service to the family of the victims. We keep paying lip service to everybody involved. We've practically done nothing. And the various instances that have been happening over the years bear witness to the fact that we've learned nothing. From the government perspective, through the ordinary Ghanaian, to everybody involved, we've learned nothing. If you remember, one of the recommendations of the Okojeto Commission was that at any point in time that the ministry or government wanted to take any decision regarding spectators, the stakeholders, in this case the sports authority and the security services, must be involved. But not quite long ago, Honorable Ayariga single-handedly went on radio to declare that the Black Stars, I've forgotten the match, one of the matches at the Kumasi Sports Stadium after the World Cup. He single-handedly declared free gate without involving the stakeholders. I remember talking to the sports authorities, and nobody was aware. The security agencies, nobody was aware. It tells you that even the ministry has learned nothing from the Okojeto report, not to talk about the Ghana Football Association, which is responsible for organizing local football. There hasn't been any legislation to control crowd violence, nothing. From government, the story isn't any different. The clubs involved, look at the impunity with which Kotoko and Hartlepool treat even the celebration of May 9. Even playing a common friendly match in honor of the victims is a problem. It tells you that practically we have learned nothing.
Sure, but what about the people who lost their lives, their families, their children and wives? Has the state been able to, kind of compensate them?
I don't think we have. The story isn't different. A few individuals have made efforts to comfort the families, but from the state, there hasn't been anything practical. I know year in, year out, people like Herbert Mensah, Marisa Cole, and a few football officials who were there on the day make efforts to visit the families and make some donations. But the state, we have done nothing, and it is very sad because it is the greatest football disaster on the continent. And every year, we keep paying lip service, paying tributes to the bereaved, paying tribute to the family and all that with our lips, and practically doing nothing about it. I'm sure we're only hoping and praying that it wouldn't happen again, because practically,
As a sports analyst and looking at the way the police in particular control crowd after that incident, have you seen any change in the approach?
Not at all. I was looking forward to seeing the European style where stewards are made to keep an eye on the spectators and identify spectators who go against the law by going violent at the various stadia. But we're still using the old system where some police officers, not everybody, or some security officers will be the first to jump in the air when their team score at the various stadia. So practically, we have learned nothing. The police have learned nothing. The nation, we've learned nothing. The Football Association, it is all about the lip service, and that's it.
Tomorrow is the day, our lessons and moving forward. What do you have to tell us?
I think that if there would be anything practical concerning crowd violence and learning lessons from May 9, it should be from leadership. And if I say leadership, I'm talking about the state. I'm talking about the Ghana Football Association, the major stakeholders who control sporting activities in the country. If they take the lead, obviously the ordinary Ghanaian on the street will fall in line. We, the sports journalists, would also back them by using our media houses to also tell the ordinary Ghanaian that let's do A, B, C to make sure we do not revisit what happened on May 9, 14 years ago. But until that is done, it will be the same thing year in, year out.
All right. We want to thank you very much for joining us tonight on Behind the News, live here on Radio Ghana. Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Dan Kweku Yeboah is a sports analyst, and that is how we will end this week's edition of Behind the News. Producers were Christopher Siedu, Agatha Samoa, Berland Elom Tete, Ejeni Mbwaten Eji, Frank Owusu Ansa, and Hannah Owusu Bempa were our sound engineers. My name is George Asikri. Enjoy your weekend.